This is Karen Brewster, and today is May 3rd, 2019, and I'm here with John Jackson, his home in Dayton, Wyoming, and this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So, John, thank you.
Certainly.
Letting me come visit you today, and why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself before we get into your work with the park?
Well, I came to Skagway in 1975 to teach fifth grade and be the wrestling coach.
Uh-huh.
And I arrived on the ferry in August of 75 and was met at the ferry by the superintendent of schools, Dusty Mills. And he gave me a tour of the town and the school, and I actually spent that first night with he and his wife in their home. And then I had a little trouble finding a place to live.
Right.
Which is...
Even back then?
Even back then. It wasn't nearly as bad as it is today, but...
Right.
My first apartment was in the White House.
Oh, okay.
When Nova and Wanda Warner were the proprietors.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, so the school year started out and went quite well. We had 20 kids in fifth grade, and the school at that time was the old building on okay. Now demolished. It was on between 11th and 12th, on right off of State Street, between State and Alaska. And
so where did you come from originally?
I grew up in Iowa, moved to Colorado Springs when in the middle of my senior year of high school. So graduated from a high school in Colorado Springs, went to college in Gunnison, Colorado, a western state. And came away 5 years later with a elementary education degree. And let's see, a student taught in Colorado Springs, and did a I taught in the fall of 70. Our student taught in the fall of 72. Was able to get a sub-teaching job in that same school in the third grade that spring, 73.
Mm-hmm.
And then that summer, I was actually working in Nebraska for my uncle, leveling land and eating a lot of dirt. So I was able to secure a teaching job in Walden, Colorado, in North Park, about 60 miles south of Laramie. And I taught there 2 years, and then my sister and brother-in-law at the time were headed for Alaska, and I says, "Oh, I'll just come along." And so I was able to get a teaching job in Skagway on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewed over the phone with Mr. Mills in Oregon, I think, and he says, "Come on up." So We drove to Prince Rupert and took the ferry to Skagway.
Mm-hmm.
Their teaching gigs were in Wrangell.
Oh, okay.
So they got off there, and I went on ahead to Skagway. And taught 2 years in the Skagway school and decided it wasn't for me. And the park was opening in the spring of 77.
Okay.
And I was able to get a job as a interpreter / relief ranger. So that was the, of course, those were days when all the buildings that the park now owns were in real poor shape,
right,
falling into the ground and leaning. And one of those buildings was the old railroad depot, which is on the corner of 2nd and Broadway,
mm-hmm,
where the visitor center is now.
Right.
Well, in those days, it had been abandoned for years. So they set up a visitor center in the, what is now the reception area of the depot. And they had a little office in the corner, which I believe must have been a dispatch office at one time. But at the time we were there, the floor was settling, and particularly in the office area in that corner, was settling real bad. And mm-hmm. so it was pretty rustic. But they had blown up, as far as interpretive tools, there were a series of big black and white photos from historic Skagway on the walls, which we led people around and talked to them about. Mm-hmm. And they had a curious collection of two or three white audio chairs. You'd sit in the chair and you'd be surrounded by this plastic shell, and it was recordings of, I think, Steve Heitz, who's mm-hmm. now a successful tour operator in Skagway. He's also a musician and was at that time working on the railroad and writing songs and singing them, and so a recording of his songs were in those chairs.
Hmm.
That was pretty much the extent of the. Well, we had a movie we could show. It was behind this black bisqueen curtain in an area that's now in the current depot. It is now, there's an open area just east of the visitor center. But now it's enclosed. Of course, now they have a theater.
Right.
At that time, that open area was covered, and that was our theater. I don't remember the movie we showed. But at any rate, there were, that first summer, Dick Hoffman was a superintendent. He's the one that hired me. We had four interpreters. And on the Chilkoot, there were two rangers. There must have been four. But at any rate, once a month, one of us would get to go up on the trail and stay at sheep camp and give the rangers days off. So that was a treat. We'd get to hike up to sheep camp and man the station and do what we could with the hikers and patrol the summit and every day. And then we'd walk out to Bennett and take the train home at the end of our week.
Oh, you didn't hike back down?
No. So that was a treat. Great job. And so that in addition to the to that building, the old railroad depot building, there was of course the Lynch and Kennedy building, there was the Mascot, all the nicely preserved buildings that welcome visitors now were falling down.
Mm-hmm.
So
did the park own them yet?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yeah. So I worked that summer, and then the following summer, the park was involved with, in the spring of 78, I guess it was, the park was involved with moving the Dai Cemetery, which is mostly a native cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
But it was being encroached upon by the Taya River. And so nothing would do, but the bodies needed to be exhumed and moved to another site, which they are now. We moved them over by the Slide Cemetery in
mm-hmm.
Dai. And that was an interesting project. There was a crew of us, several people, exhuming the graves and trying to preserve everything. And map everything, and we were under the direction of a archaeologist from Anchorage, from the Anchorage office. I do not recall his name. So that job lasted for a month or so. So that was as far as my work with the park. Then later on, in a year or so, I worked with the park when they started to refurbish their buildings, which involved a lot of work under the buildings to excavate and prepare to lift them up and try to level them and that sort of work. So, I don't know about specific years. I did that for a couple of summers. I was under the mascot, worked a little bit on the Lynch and Kennedy. I remember roofing on the buildings that where Sue would eventually have her shop.
The cribs?
The cribs. And the verbal ways.
Okay. So when you were doing that interpretation that first year in 77, you said there were four interpretive rangers and maybe four trail rangers.
Right.
Do you remember the names of any of those people?
Doug Sandvik was on the trail. And Phil, I can't remember his last name.
Okay.
And there were, there were two women, Meg Jensen, who I think rather later worked up north.
Was Roy Nelson working there yet?
No, Roy was on the pipeline.
Oh, okay.
Those were his pipeline days. I think he graduated from high school in 74 and went right up north.
And who were your other interpretive rangers you worked with?
There was Linda Chesney, Chesney, and Craig Juline. And one other fella, we probably called him Red because he had red hair, but I don't remember his real name. We were in uniform and manning the visitor center. I think we'd work maybe one or two people in there at a time. Of course, we didn't have the thousands of visitors that we have now. This was, you know, 77. The railroad was still operating, of course.
Did you have a sense of how many visitors you'd get in a summer for the park?
We seldom had more than a handful of people in the visitor center at a time.
Oh, were cruise ships coming in yet?
Yes, but it was, I'm guessing it was like 10 or 20 ships a year.
Okay. Instead of a day.
Yeah.
I know that depot building was in disrepair until the Park Service fixed it up and made it their visitor center and administrative buildings, but I didn't realize you guys could be in it in 77. It was safe enough?
Apparently. Yeah, we didn't. It's not like we had bathrooms or, you know, obviously anything like that. But it was deemed safe. And, you know, it's a big building and structurally pretty sound. The floor was kind of wavy.
And that was just for the visitor center. The Park Service offices were still In like the where were the Park Service offices?
The offices, the superintendent had offices above the what is it now? It's right across the street from the hardware store on 4th and Broadway.
Okay. Was there a grocery store or something?
There was a grocery store there at one time. Riwi's grocery was there. But I don't think it was operated in the time that I was that I was there. It might have been the building just north of the grocery store.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say, but it wasn't in the depot building yet.
No, so the superintendent was up there and he had a secretary and I don't know that there was much of a maintenance staff even.
Yeah.
At that time.
And all of you Rangers were only seasonal, right? Were there any other, who would have been a year-round employee?
At that time, the super, they were bringing in just temporary people to evaluate the buildings.
Right.
From Denver or Anchorage. And those people would stay for months. There was a fellow from Denver who was in Skagway and met quite a few folks. When the park opened, they had a celebration on Broadway in, must have been early June of 77. And the community band played, and I played in the band. And what else can I tell
was
you?
Was the, for that park opening celebration, what was the sense in the community? Were they happy to have a park there or not?
There was mixed sentiment. There were some people who had worked real hard to get the park there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was probably, at that time, there were probably more detractors than, because they were, you know, didn't want to be encroached upon. They were used to having their way in Dyea and with hunting and fishing and use of the area. Mm-hmm. Prior to the park's presence. That sentiment is, I would like to think, it's dwindled over the years and been assuaged, but the park brought in some real good people who understood the community and worked with the community and were aware of the sentiments, which I'm sure is the case in most parks.
Mm-hmm. But at that time, what was the superintendent like? Dick Hoffman, you said?
Yes. He was probably the least effective of the superintendents they've had. He had a substance abuse problem.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't last but a year or two. I don't remember if Clay Alderson was one of the early superintendents, and he was real good.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure when Clay showed up, but he
86.
Was... 86. Really? That late?
Mm-hmm.
So he probably wasn't Dick's successor.
No, Dick Sims? Is that a familiar name?
Yeah.
He may have been in between there.
Okay.
I know he was there in 84, in 80, I think he was even there. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know all of them, but these are names I've heard people say.
Right, right.
So do you remember Dick Sims?
Not specifically. When I was doing the construction work in the 79 through 82, I'd usually get hired on as a seasonal carpenter's helper or whatever. Mm-hmm. And my supervisors, my earliest one I remember is, his name is Hank, let me get this right, Ablanop? A-B-P-L-A-N-A-U-P, that's a brutalization. A couple of young architects, Ray Todd was a young architect and supervisor.
And now was Hank with the Parks Maintenance Department?
He was an early construction boss.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he was more concerned with the restoration.
Okay. And then you said Ray Todd, other people you can remember?
Not really. Some of the local guys, like, I'm not sure when. Cy.
Dennis.
Cy Dennis.
Junior.
Junior,
okay.
Yeah. He probably started working for them in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. He just retired like last year,
I think. Yeah.
The other Lady Ranger, I think her last name was Ross. I remember she was involved with the Outdoor Leadership School, her other job. I don't remember her first name.
So when you did the, I'm going back to the beginning with your first job in 77 as the interpreter, did they provide any kind of training for you?
It was mostly a suggested reading. There was one book or one paper written by a gentleman who had hiked the trail and taken copious notes and wrote a paper.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was some history. Of course, history of Skagway. One of the suggested readings was Skagway in Days of Primeval by Captain Moore's son,
mm-hmm.
which I don't think I ever made it through that one.
Was it? Why?
Well, it was.
I've not read it.
Pretty disjointed, and he was not a writer.
Okay.
So.
So do you remember any of the, not word for word, interpretive presentations you gave, but what the general gist and themes were that you presented to visitors?
I think we based a lot of our work on trying to share the story with the visitors from the photographs on the wall.
Okay.
There was, the photographs were, one was the most, one that sticks in my mind is the one taken on Broadway when the rails still went up and down mm-hmm. Broadway. So that was, I think those rails were taken up in the 30s, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah. But that was an impressive picture. There was probably pictures from the old photographs from the Chilkoot Trail.
Right.
And the Golden Stairs were probably on there.
That classic picture.
Oh, yeah.
And were there any artifacts that you had to use to help tell the story?
We may have had an old shoe or something like that from the Chilkoot. At that time, we really didn't.
So did you write your own presentations, or was it given to you by somebody?
No, we were given free license to talk about whatever struck us. And we each had probably different interpretations, to overuse a word. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really scripted.
Do you remember what your particular emphasis or interest was?
I basically just talked about the pictures on the wall and tried to include things that I thought were pertinent. Tried to present a picture of the gold rush, mm-hmm. and why we were there.
And if you had any particular favorite little stories that you remember you told?
I don't.
It was quite a while ago.
Well, there you go.
was there somebody who was head of interpretation?
No.
So you all just reported to the superintendent?
Yeah, and it's not like he was supervising that closely.
Right.
So yeah, we were given free rein. Right.
And nowadays, of course, the Rangers do walking tours.
They do.
Did you do that then?
No, we did not. No, that was a pretty late development, as mm-hmm. I recall, with the walking tours. I mean, they've been doing them now for 20 years.
Right.
But we didn't do walking tours, which was unfortunate, because the tour activity and opportunities for visitors was pretty limited, mm-hmm. As far as compared to the myriad of shore excursions available now.
Right.
There was the train, and that was about it.
Well, and in that time, the train was still an operational passenger freight service, right?
It was.
And it went all the way to Whitehorse still?
Yes. Yes, they had passenger service to Whitehorse until 82, I believe. Mm-hmm.
And did the tourists who came into town on the cruise ships, did they go onto the train?
Yes.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, yeah. They had the trains were able to back right down to the dock.
Oh.
I think the railroad dock was the dock on the east side of the valley.
Right.
This was the original dock, and was the only one. The ore terminal was not used as a cruise ship berth.
The ore terminal was already there?
Yes.
Okay. Oh yeah, it would have been, because loaded up the ships.
In 69, 70 was when they started that whole show.
But so the tourists would get on the train and ride it, but it didn't have the whole spiel that they do now, right?
The railroad offered what they call the Bennett Turn, which was probably the Bennett Turn was a round tripper, and probably, I think it was just a passenger train.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Bennett, served lunch in the eating house, and then returned
to
Skagway. The freight trains were running mostly at night, hauling the ore.
Mm-hmm. And would tourists just take the train up to Whitehorse to see Whitehorse?
And besides the Bennett Turn, they could also go to Whitehorse, yeah. Or come down from Whitehorse.
Right.
If they flew into Whitehorse or what have you.
Okay. I just thought about something else about the train but that the train went all the way to the cruise ships out at the dock, which is different than now.
Right? Oh, it still does.
It still goes all the way out?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Sometimes
yeah.
That's the...
Yeah. They've... the track got moved over right on the dock.
Okay.
It was right on the mountain on its own roadbed.
Oh.
Which is, the roadbed is still there.
But they moved it closer to the boats, I guess.
Right.
Do you know why they moved it?
Just for convenience. for safety.
Do you remember when that happened?
It was after I started on the railroad in 88. I think it was perhaps 1990.
Okay.
When they moved the track over on the railroad dock.
When you said, you know, in 77, there weren't that many visitors coming through and not so many cruise ships. Do you know why that changed, why that's increased so much?
Just the general tourism traffic in Alaska, to mm-hmm. Alaska. I mean, the railroad shut down in 82 when they lost the Anvil Mine. Mm-hmm. And reopened in 88 just for passenger service, a seasonal passenger service. Mm-hmm. And I think that first year the railroad hauled, oh my goodness, what was it? Maybe 20,000 people.
Wow.
Now they're hauling over 400,000.
Wow.
Of course, they have a lot more trains.
Right. Well, yeah, and I was just wondering, like, what happened between 77 and 88 to shift that number of people?
It was just a matter of having the ships with the people to justify the...
Mm-hmm.
The traffic was generally, was slowly building up over those years.
Mm-hmm.
And finally in 88 they said, okay, well, it looks like we can make money, you know,
right.
Bring the service back.
Right. So. Do you think the city of Skagway or the park or individual people went out to the Lower 48 in the tourist market
and sold
Skagway?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We had a dynamic state tourism office, and it, you know, I think there was an ad on the Super Bowl one year in those early years.
Oh.
It was quite the deal. But that's how it got built up.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in knowing more about the movement of the cemetery in Dyea, because I think that's a very specialized thing you did, that not many people
True.
Did that.
It's a star on my resume.
So, yeah, how did you get involved with that? And you kind of gave a summary of it, but maybe we can remember some of the details.
They needed to move the cemetery because the Taya was encroaching. It was, originally it was, as you cross the bridge into Dyea, it was on a point of land south of that bridge, probably a quarter mile. Hmm. We exhuming the graves, I remember some individuals or names. There was, the names are now in the, we tried to keep the gravestones and
mm-hmm.
or mark the graves best we could from what we.
Did you do it one grave at a time by hand?
It was all hand dug, yeah.
So you hand dug out, you hand dug to exhume.
Right.
And then you moved to the new cemetery location. Did you hand dig those graves?
I think so. Yeah.
Usually
the caskets were deteriorated.
Right.
And it was just skeletons. Clothing.
Hmm.
There was some clothing. And shoes. I really don't remember actual skeletons just very much. But... I remember some clothing and trying to keep everything together and record things that we found. There may have been some jewelry. There may have been some gold teeth. I think I remember Sophie Matthews, I believe, was one of the people in the cemetery. There was, I don't know if Skookum Jim from of Gold Rush fame was there, but possibly a relative.
Mm-hmm.
Same last name.
Was Jim. Not Jim was the last name?
No.
Yeah, what was his last name? He was Skookum Jim. Well, it doesn't matter.
It's
written down so many places.
Yeah.
Now, who was Sophie Matthews?
Sophie Matthews was, I really don't know her history. I think the Matthews family was a native family in the area. There was some concern by some local natives in Skagway, very few, about disturbing those graves.
Mm-hmm.
But they were about to be washed away. It was inevitable. And, you know, it's a good thing we did.
Yeah, so did any members of the local native community come out to the work site? And
no, I don't remember ever seeing anybody on site. Larry Jocko was one of the, I think he had ancestors in there.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was originally from Haines, his family was. He worked as a conductor on the railroad,
mm-hmm.
and has a family in Skagway.
Yeah, I know their name.
Yeah.
So that cemetery in Dyea was mostly Native people, you think?
Yes. Yeah. Because, of course, there was a major Native settlement in Dyea originally.
Mm-hmm.
The Packers.
Right.
Well,
I knew that the Native history going back and forth there, but I always thought, like, at least in Skagway, that they didn't really live there very much. But in Dyea, they did settle there, or seasonally at least.
Right, right. Yeah. Wayne Greenstreet was one of the people on the crew who was probably still in Skagway.
Was Carl Gerke helping with the archaeology?
No, Carl wasn't there yet.
He wasn't there yet, okay.
The archaeologist was, I believe, out of Anchorage. I don't remember his name.
Wasn't Ted Burkadahl?
No.
I know I've read it, the name. I can't think of it. But that's what I was wondering, is how you knew where to dig. And, you know, I mean, say it's something you have to really keep track of very carefully.
Yeah. The I think there were still some gravestones. And I don't know just... I don't remember what years that cemetery was active.
Mm-hmm.
But it was long before I got there.
Mm-hmm. And were you very closely supervised then by that archaeologist?
Yes.
That they were there on site whenever you...
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if there were no skeletons, we'll say the caskets were had fallen apart.
Right.
Were there
they
pieces?
Were just rotted wood.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would think there would have still been some bones left.
Yeah.
But you don't remember that?
I don't remember that specifically. No.
Blocked it out of your memory.
Well, I don't remember it being spooky or unpleasant. I mean, we were really trying to preserve everything.
Mm-hmm.
And,
do you remember how many people were on the crew?
There may have been six of us.
And what kind of a work schedule did you have?
I think it was just 8-hour days.
Oh, yeah.
Five of them.
Do you remember how long it took?
3 to 4 weeks.
That's not so long.
No.
Do you remember how many graves total?
I think there were fewer than 20.
Okay. And they were all moved to the Slide Cemetery?
Near the Slide Cemetery, yeah. And that then there's, you know, a separate area for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably very clearly marked by now.
Right. At the time.
I mean, the Slide Cemetery has undergone some refurbishment and preservation.
But it was already there in 78.
It was. It sure was.
Well, yeah, it would have been. When was that slide?
In 1898.
Yeah.
April 98.
Yeah. So, do you have any memory of who at the park might have planned and supervised this cemetery move and deciding where to put the new graves?
No.
Because somebody must have said, put this one there, put that one there.
Oh. No, nothing that specific. I mean, unless the archaeologist did.
Yeah.
I mean, he obviously told us where to put them. I think they were given new caskets. I think they built wooden caskets for them.
Okay.
And so we would deposit the remains in a wooden casket. And they were just rough lumber. I don't remember who built them.
But they were. You remember that they were there, though.
Yeah.
And you think the archaeologist told you where to put the new graves?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wonder if they did clearance on this site. If they, when you dug up those new holes, you know, was there any archaeological material that was found? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I mean, it was adjacent to the Slide Cemetery,
right.
But it would have been in a remote area, so it's not like it was a settled area and evidence of people being there.
Right. Yeah, I was just wondering, the archaeologist somebody decided that location was a good place to move it to.
Yes.
Maybe because it was by the Slide Cemetery already.
Right.
I don't know. So then you said you worked on the some of the building reconstruction.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Let's see. The railroad shut down in 82.
Right.
And by then, the park had purchased some buildings and was actively trying to restore them.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired a pretty big crew.
Right.
Did
you have carpentry experience?
A little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just from in the years between my summer at the park and working for the park with the restoration. Worked with a private contractor, Jim Jewell, who later became Jewell Construction and did a lot of construction on Broadway.
Is that the same as Jewell Gardens, Jewell?
His wife.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, so the big crew, and gosh, it must have been, the railroad shut down in the fall of 82. I'm guessing maybe the spring, summer of 83, they hired the big crew to start working on buildings. Some of us were working, I remember a couple of conductors off the railroad who had carpentry experience were working there. Lee Hartson and Larry Sullivan. We're both working on that crew.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hank was there then. And that would have been when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
I think my last summer working for the park and the restoration was 85.
Okay.
And I remember working on the Verbuiti building, where Sue's shop was. Mm-hmm.
What did you do on that building, you remember?
We were putting a new roof on it. Apparently, the other work had been done. Terry Jacobson was on that crew. Which Molly boy? One of the M-A-H-L-E, Doug Molly was working on that crew. I think Doug Sandvik, the former ranger on the trail, was working on that crew. Mm-hmm. That's about it that I can remember.
Were those buildings safe enough to be up on the roof?
Well, that one had been fixed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In 1980, I also worked for a private contractor putting the foundation under the old depot building.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I heard that that was a complicated job.
I remember I was working for Ole Schlettevold and John Poljasek. They had formed a partnership and were working as a contractor. Mm-hmm. And I worked with those guys for that foundation under the depot building, mm-hmm. as well as the pack train restoration, which was not a park building, it was still privately owned.
And is that, where is that?
The pack train is the corner of 4th and Broadway.
Okay. So what did you do on that foundation? Were you pouring the cement?
Yes, yes. There was a lot of excavation underneath. The pouring the cement, we poured the footers and built a pony wall for the exterior. The interior was post and pad and post. In order to pour the pads, we'd form them up underneath, but we actually use a hole saw and drill a hole above each pad and be able to wheelbarrow the cement in and pour it through a tube into the hole down to the pad below. So rather than trying to get cement through a narrow space,
right,
we just poured it through the floor.
You just cut a hole in the floor of the building.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because I've heard that you couldn't raise it up high enough that's why they had to excavate down, and that
right.
made it hard to get right. under there for the cement.
Right.
I don't know enough about how cement foundations are constructed.
Right. We poured a footer through for the perimeter and built what they call a pony wall. It was only probably 2 or 3 feet high, just a framed lumber wall.
Okay. And then you pour the cement into that.
Right.
Frame.
We were able to, on the exterior, they were able to pour it from the outside.
Okay.
But on the to pour the pads under the interior of the building, they had to. Of course, it was an original floor. It was pretty thick,
and they. And they let you cut holes in it?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Because it was all going to get restored anyway.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And the floor was still in place because they put new joists in, right?
Probably. Or shored them up where they could.
Right.
Just.
So the posts you were putting in, you poured the footer And then there was like wooden posts that they, or piers that they'd built?
Right, the pad, and then the post would sit on top of that with a hardware to hold it in place on the...
But don't you have to put that post in when the cement's wet?
Nope.
Oh.
No, after it hardens, you just set it on top.
Oh.
We probably poured in a... In when we poured the cement, we had a post holder fixed in the cement, and you just plant the post on that and fasten it.
Okay.
And then...
But when you poured the cement down there for that footer, had you built a frame so that would keep the cement a certain shape and depth and all that?
Sure. Sure.
So how did you get down there to build that?
Well, that was like a 4-foot space. I mean, a man could get down there, but you didn't really want to push a wheelbarrow through there,
right,
with full of cement.
And you didn't have hoses or anything that you could...
We didn't have the pump trucks that they have now.
Okay. And they... So the only option was...
Yeah, so that was how they did it.
Okay. That's the key, is that the technology was different.
Yes. Yes. Certainly was.
Well, and I know that these were Park Service buildings, that they had this big crew that was working on the restoration, but they hired contractors to do some of it?
Yes. And I would say over the years, that's been an exception to hire a contractor. They mostly did it with their own people.
Mm-hmm.
Even the more recent work they've done on the building on Fifth, the YMCA building,
mm-hmm.
that's mostly done with Parks people. And see, when did they build their shop?
Early to mid-90s.
Yeah,
that
sounds about right.
Yeah, because Doreen did all the archaeological clearance work on that.
Oh, she did.
A lot of it, I think. Yeah. But do you know why they hired the contractor for that foundation?
Because they could. And I they probably didn't have a, they didn't want to put on a, they were, you know, finding themselves, you know, and trying to get established, and in order to just build up their workforce and whatever over the years and decide what they wanted to do, they used a contractor.
I was wondering if it is because it was cement that that's not something the Park Service had the equipment or talent.
Right, there, that's a lot of it too.
And now they do have those sort of opportunities in the Park Service?
I don't know how much of the foundation work they do. Well, they're not really building with. I think they built the shop, but that was contracted out.
And the YMCA Meyer building, I don't know if they needed foundation work done.
Probably, but I don't either. I don't either.
I just assume every old building in Skagway is going to need to be lifted up.
Yeah.
You know, because they didn't build cement foundations in those days.
Right, right. Sometimes they didn't really have a foundation.
Yeah. That's why they were falling apart. Yeah,
exactly.
So in those years you worked for the park, you were working seasonally.
Yes.
What did you do in the wintertime?
Usually travel. Go see my family.
Mm-hmm.
My sister was in the Seattle area at the time. My parents were in Colorado. Sometimes I'd take road trips with friends.
Is at this point you and Sue were not yet married?
That's correct. We didn't meet until 91.
Right, because she was not there till 91.
Exactly.
That's what she told me before. So what was it like working for the Park Service in those early years?
It was okay. I mean, I was usually under a building and
mm-hmm.
didn't leave my hard hat behind. It was a good job. It paid okay.
Mm-hmm. What were the other people like?
Mostly just local guys, friends. Very much knew who we were working with.
And mm-hmm.
That was helpful.
Do you feel like the Park Service made an effort to hire locally? Or yes. They did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. For that type of work, there was plenty of help.
Mm-hmm. And when you were the interpretive ranger, you were sort of local at that point.
Yeah, I'd been there a couple of years.
Yeah, but the other people were all from outside?
They were.
And how did that work? Yeah,
California. I think they're all from California. Doug and Phil had been, it was not their first summer on the trail. I think they had experience originally working out of Glacier Bay.
Oh, okay.
They were on the trail. They established a trail presence out of Glacier Bay before the park actually came into existence. And I don't remember if the state parks had a presence and influence, but I'm pretty sure Doug and Phil were hired out of Glacier Bay.
Well, I know that there's...
And then Scott Sappington, well, he's changed his name to Scott Holm. He and Doug were, I think, the original rangers on the trail. And that was before I got there. So they were working out of Glacier Bay.
So what was that trail like back in 77?
Well, I haven't been on it since. It was a trail. I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, there was in the ensuing years, they've had some flooding. I don't remember any flooding.
Was it brushed out? You could follow it.
Yeah. Yes, it was. I remember when I was up there for a week or so, I remember building a makeshift bridge across the creek that was needed to have a bridge. That was right near the sheep camp.
Okay, yeah, that was my question. Were there bridges, or did they get washed out?
There weren't. If they had bridges, there were very few and pretty old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember any bridges.
So you had to
except the one I built.
Right, so you had to do creek crossings.
Yeah, which was pretty rudimentary, because we were not trained for that or didn't have the materials, and unlike nowadays when they do have those things and they helicopter in materials and
right. So, yeah, I was
do
saying,
things right according to government specs and the whole thing.
Yeah, that bridge you built, what did you build it out of? How did you build it?
Just threw a couple of logs across the creek, and I think we call it the bridge not for the faint of heart. And, you know, non-disclaimer.
No railings?
Oh, no.
And did you have a chain?
You probably couldn't jump across it, but you needed a bridge.
Yeah.
And it was right near the sheep camp, if not in sheep camp.
And did you have a chainsaw to cut some local trees down to use?
Don't remember a chainsaw.
Or were those logs already down?
They were probably already down. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying, is what kind of supplies did you have for building a bridge?
Yeah. And like I say, rudimentary. Not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
It was not government approved.
And the other places where you had to cross the river or creeks, you just waded through?
Yeah, I don't remember wading. And of course, those are, I don't know, drier years, I don't know.
Or there were enough rocks you could hop across.
Right.
And there were no approved campgrounds yet at that time, were there?
There was, there's still a camp at Canyon City, which was not, I mean, there were no tents, or there was a shelter at Sheep Camp at that time. So that would probably have been done by the state people or...
Yeah.
I don't remember Doug or Scott saying anything about building the shelter at Sheep Camp, but it was a building with bunk beds.
Okay.
Rangers had wall tents. Um,
And at Canyon City, was there anything there?
Boy.
Or Finnegan's?
I think it was just campsites. And, you know, Finnegan's, there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you said you would then hike on up over out to Bennett. So what about Happy Camp and Lindemann's and all those ones on the Canadian side?
Oh, those folks were living in style.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Canadians. That was the highlight of summer, to go to Lindemann and have dinner with the Canadian Rangers. They had a nice wall tent.
Yeah. But it was still a wall tent?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. They had... I think that was the only building, or the only camp that was at Lindemann where the Rangers stayed.
Okay.
Of course, they patrol like we did to the summit.
Yeah, so there wasn't even a Happy Camp facility.
I don't remember one. No, I doubt it.
So when you said you patrolled, what does that mean? What did you do?
We'd walk from Sheep Camp to the summit, make sure the hikers are getting over, and just ensure the safety of the trail and the hikers.
How was the trail marked up over the summit, or was it?
Not particularly. I mean, it was still the big scree area.
Mm-hmm.
You gained a lot of sympathy for the Stampeders.
Right. So how did you know where the... Or how would a hiker know where the trail was?
Just following the wear on the rocks. I mean, mm-hmm. You could see the trail at the top, and the trail led right up to the scree.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. We didn't have any other markers in the scree area. I don't know what they do now.
Yeah, I think they do now.
Do they?
Well, yeah. I mean, and you think about those clouds come in, and you can't see the summit.
There you go.
So, if hikers ever got lost...
They may have. I don't recall anything.
Not in your time?
Yeah. Did we have any communication? We may have had... I think we had a radio. And... the reception was pretty poor. I guess we must have been talking to town. I don't think we were talking to Glacier Bay.
Yeah.
There was... when we went up for a week, one of the regular rangers would be there to direct us.
So it wasn't just you in town guys.
Do stuff they didn't want to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Like?
I mean, they could have. I don't remember anything particularly disagreeable.
But the one of the regular rangers was still there with you.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't just by yourself.
Right.
But do you remember any rescuing of hikers?
No. No, we were very fortunate because we were not trained to do that sort of thing.
Did the regular rangers ever talk about having done that?
Not at that time.
Yeah. When, again, there weren't as many people
exactly
on the trail. I'm a little surprised that there were enough hikers using the trail to justify having, you know, two rangers there at all times.
Yeah, well, I mean, an established, popular backpacking trail, even then.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't get near the traffic that it does
right
now.
Do you remember, like, how many people would be using it?
I remember my times up there, the sheep camp shelter was quite often pretty full.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea of specific numbers.
Besides you know, having meals with the Canadian Rangers, do you remember what the relationship between the U.S. and the Canadian side was and how that worked?
On the trail, it was very good. Yeah, Parks Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Christine was still there. Well, she was there. She might still be there.
She Christine Hansen, is that her last name? No.
No.
I know the name.
Yeah.
Carl's mentioned it. I think she still is. But she was the ranger back then?
Yeah. She was married then to Manfred. They were both rangers. Christine and Manfred.
So were you able to communicate with them?
I don't think so. I mean, we'd see them at the summit.
Right.
There was a building there. It was an outhouse. It looked like an outhouse, but it wasn't really an outhouse, but it was just a shelter.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember any specific radio communications from there.
But you guys would meet and exchange information or whatever?
Yeah.
And at that point, there wasn't the permit system for hiking the trail, was there?
Oh, no. No, there wasn't. I don't know that anybody even had to register that they were on the trail.
Yeah.
So.
And was there, that was why I was asking, because, you know, now, don't the Parks Canada Rangers check passports now? You're crossing the Canadian border.
No idea. Yeah.
And was there any thought about that at the time that you're crossing the Canadian border?
No. The nearest customs station would have been at Whitehorse.
Oh, because the Klondike Highway wasn't there.
Right. They started working, they were working on the Klondike. It opened, I think, in 78.
Okay.
That was my summer job in 78. One of my summer jobs in 78.
Yeah, because you worked on the cemetery.
Yeah, that was in the spring, and then I got involved in community theater, even in my teaching days.
Mm.
And I got involved in the Days of 98 show.
Oh.
And I did that for a number of summers. But in summer 78, it was a pretty busy summer. I got hired on, it must have been in, I think it was August. I got hired on to by the state for on a survey crew to remeasure excavation and fill. There was a dispute with the contractor.
The Klondike Highway?
On the Klondike Highway, yeah, sorry. So that was another job.
So what does that mean?
I was a chainman, so I got to grab one end of a tape and scurry up the side of the rock face and hold the tape and measure how far from centerline we were. And we had an instrument of sorts from, 1978, measure the angle and compute how much material was moved.
Hmm. And so did it solve the dispute?
No idea. Over my pay grade.
You just provided the data and that
was
it?
Yes.
I was going to ask about the trail in 77. Bears. It was late to the hikers and safety. And did you ever have to deal with bears?
No. No, we didn't even have bear spray. There was no, I never saw a bear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember any reports of a bear.
Did you have to carry a weapon?
Oh, no.
Oh. Well, you were interpretive ranger. What training, weapons training would you have had?
Yeah, or first aid for that matter.
Oh, really? No first aid training?
No.
Well, the regular ranger on the trail must have had those trainings.
Presumably.
So when you went up for a week, so you were on the trail for a week while they had a week off?
Mm-hmm.
And then so each of you interpretive rangers would, one of you would go up?
Yeah, I think I got up to go there, I got to go there twice over the summer.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me about the Days of 98 show. That sounds pretty fun.
Well, when I got to town, it was the Days of 98 show started way back in the possibly the 20s or
30s. Isn't it Martin Itchen start it, I think?
I don't know if it was that early. It was a community show. It was done in the Eagles Hall. And I think the Eagles Auxiliary started it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some dramatic skits. They did the shooting of Dan McGrew. They had a character named Queenie who was dressed in costume and would select she'd do a narration and she'd go grab a guy out of the audience and dance with him. And they had a little band. Cy Coyne Sr. was had a beautiful voice and he was in the band. I think also anyway, my first involvement was the summer of, must have been 76, between my teaching years.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go do the show. And I sang Daisy Daisy with Barbara Moore. We had gambling. We had phony gambling before, and then they'd, with phony money, and they, so the community did it through 77, and then there was a couple of guys down the street who started the Soapy Smith Show in, I don't know what year they started, probably 75, maybe 74. The fellow's name was Biss. Tom Biss was Soapy. And his sidekick, one of his sidekicks, was Jim Richards. And I think Steve Heitz was also in that show.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jim approached the Eagles about moving that Soapy Smith show up to the Eagles Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Biss left town, Jim took the helm, and the Eagles was essentially inactive. So Jim and some of his friends, myself included, became Eagles.
Just to keep the chapter
going and to establish a venue for his show. And we also, besides doing the Soapy Show, which was pretty much a one-man show, we tried to recreate the Days of 98 show, which they actually wrote a play for.
Mm-hmm.
And had a cast of many people.
Right.
And, you know, paid them $25 a night and did shows. I think we did a show every night.
Or at least every night there was a ship in town?
No, it didn't necessarily. Well, we also had passenger traffic off the train.
Mm, that's right.
They're staying at the Klondike, what was then the Klondike Hotel. And then, so anyway, so the 78 was the first year for the Gold Rush Productions, which is what Jim called his.
So that was like the combination of the Days of 98 with the Soapy Smith production.
Yeah, well, there were separate shows, but anybody performed them both in the Eagles Hall.
Oh, okay. You didn't really combine them into one show?
We used the soap pitch in the Days of 98 show. We used some parts of the Soapy Show in the Days of 98 show.
I would think you'd have to tell the Soapy Smith story in the Days of 98.
Well, that was the gist of it. It was. It was pretty much a Soapy Smith show, but story, but with a larger cast. And it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was.
So what different parts did you play?
I was J.D. Stewart.
Who is?
J.D. Stewart was a miner that came down to Skagway and got his gold stolen by Soapy's gang.
Oh right, that sort of set.
Yeah, set off the confrontation between right. Soapy and Frank Reed.
Right.
Right. I also played in later years. I played Frank Reed. Wait a minute, did I play Frank? I played Soapy one year. It was the first time he was ever didn't have a beard.
Oh.
Yeah.
Didn't make you grow a beard?
No, they didn't. Not that I could have. But they didn't even give me a fake one.
Yeah.
But at any rate, Jim and his wife Dorothy had a child who needed with special needs. And they needed to go back to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. They found a place to help the child, but it was going to involve therapy that they had to administer.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took off in the middle of summer, and they asked me to be Soapy, and I did for a couple of weeks.
You don't sound very thrilled with it.
It was a challenge.
Why?
But it was fun. I mean, it was a major part.
Oh, yeah.
And but at that juncture in my life, I don't think I had a day job. And so I was the obvious choice. talent was kind of hard to come by. But anyway, Days 98 show.
Sounds like you enjoyed doing the show, though.
I did. I mean, that summer of 78, I ended up working up on the road for 9 hours a day. Then I'd be feed in a town and go do the show at night.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a busy year.
Yeah.
But I was young.
So. And what is it that you liked about being in the production?
I was into theater at the time. You know, I'd done some acting. And so that was an opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned community theater. Did Skagway have other community theater?
We had the Poverty Players.
Oh.
The Poverty Players in Skagway were established, when I got there.
Because you established them?
No, I didn't. I just joined in. But we did some plays in the winter time. And let's see. I actually directed a couple, which is really interesting because I really didn't have much theater experience. we did, it was in those years, I remember names of the play. Barbara Moore, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. I sang Daisy with, she was a strong proponent of the Poverty Players.
Mm.
And so they, you know, try to do a show in whichever venue in town they could heat.
So what shows do you remember doing, and then where were they performed?
We did, I was in a, I think my first play was in, must have been in the spring of 77. Myself and a woman were, it had to do with, it was called I'm Herbert. I was Herbert. And we were two old people just having a conversation. And we talked about Baltimore Orioles, and I don't remember the plot of the
I've
play.
Never even heard
yeah, we did that in the Klondike Hotel.
Oh, okay. And how much of an audience would you get?
Oh, but the whole town turned up. No, really.
which I don't know how many people in the winter.
Yeah.
Would have been.
Well, we had 30 or 40 people.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, and then in the spring of 78. 78? Nope. Must have been 79. I was on the front page of the first Skagway News as the main character in Butterflies Are Free.
Never heard of that one either.
Really? It was a cast of two men and two women. And it was directed, it must have been the spring of 78, because the Arts Council at that time in Alaska had lots of money.
Right, the Alaska State Council for the Arts?
That's what they call it now, I think.
Yeah.
We just call it the Arts Council.
Yeah.
But they were able to bring in a director.
Oh.
Who whipped us into shape, and we did Butterflies Are Free in the Presbyterian Rec Hall. With Connie Lehman, who was a coach's wife, basketball coach, his name was Don Lehman. And another woman whose name I don't recall, and the music teacher's husband. Boy, I can't believe how much I can't remember.
I'm thinking you
remember. It's pretty scary.
I think you're remembering a lot.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not going to ask you to recite any lines from the plays.
Well, thank you.
The fact that you can remember any of it is very impressive.
Oh, man.
And you probably didn't do musicals, did you?
No.
Are there any other plays you remember? How long were you involved in the community theater?
We took a play to hopefully it's still going on. They'd have a state community theater festival in Haines every year. And we took a play down there, which I directed, for lack of a better word. It would have been the spring of 77, winter, spring 77.
So before I'm Herbert?
Yes.
Okay. And what play was that?
Can't tell you.
Okay. I thought since you directed...
I remember David Moore, who was in high school at the time. He's now a successful architect in Anchorage. And Barbara was in it, and Opal LaForce was another. No, Opal was in the I'm Herbert with me.
Oh,
she was my counterpart. Yeah, I think.
Who was
and
she?
I think she was in town. Her husband worked for the power company.
Mm. And the Moores, they're not related to the original Moore family.
No. Paul and Barbara. Paul taught school, and Barbara did Poverty Players and raised children. They had 12 of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was a full-time job for her.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And then how long did the Poverty Players continue to perform?
Probably into the 80s. We took in the early 80s, Jeff Brady wrote a play it was kind of about Stroller White. But he wrote a play, and I think he directed it. I was in it. I was a crusty old newspaper man. Paul Kirk was in it. We took that play to Dawson City for a theater festival in Dawson in the spring of, oh gosh, I think I was working on a depot. I remember going to a rehearsal. Two of the kids in the play were in high school. They were Paul and Chris Kirk. Paul won an acting award in Dawson.
Hmm. At that festival?
Yeah. And I guess Jeff directed it.
You said he wrote it and directed it.
Well, he wrote and directed it. Yeah, I remember going to a rehearsal, and I had been shoveling concrete all day, and I was pretty tired. And the boys were just being boys and acting up, and I kind of got on them.
Hmm.
And anyway, that's a memory from that.
Right.
We were rehearsing in the old school. We must have performed it in Skagway, but I don't remember where.
Did you ever perform in the school?
Well,
did they have a facility for that?
Well, as a matter of fact, my first year, I got hoodwinked into directing the Christmas play, which was The Grinch That Stole Christmas.
And that they still did an annual school Christmas program?
Yeah, yeah. We did it in the school gym. Cast of thousands. I think we've pretty much included at least all the grade school kids.
Yeah, I mean, how many kids would have been in the school?
We actually had a bigger population then than they have now.
Mm, because of the railroad.
Yeah. So yeah, we had palm trees and we had a Grinch. I was teaching fifth grade. One of my kids was the Grinch. I had an adult approach me in years later and tell me she would have been in kindergarten. She was a snowflake. So from then on, she was known as Snowflake.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of help. They just needed somebody to call a director. I actually got a lot of help from the music teacher, Twyla Coughlin. She was a very good music teacher. She was actually the music teacher, and she also had the high school cheerleaders. Well, maybe not the cheerleaders, but she had a pep group, what did they call them?
Well, did they have a
drill team?
Oh,
they call them the drill team, I think.
Because they had a basketball team?
Oh, yeah.
Did they have a football team?
No.
No, it was basketball.
Just basketball, track,
yeah.
Cross country.
Well, it must have been a pretty big...
I don't think they had girls basketball then. No.
Popping
no, it
off.
Was drill team.
But yeah, that the school was big enough in the mid-70s to have that many programs and opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, our class sizes were 20 to 30, I think,
okay.
Each grade level.
Yeah. So why did you end up no longer working for the park?
They're all just seasonal jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they really didn't offer anything in the wintertime.
And so you went to work for the railroad?
Years later, yeah.
Okay.
I started out with the railroad in 88.
Okay. Well, yeah, so...
Yeah.
There's a gap. So you worked with the... Working on the buildings in the early 80s.
Yeah, I think my last... I got laid off in August of 85. We finished up the job we were doing. And let's see, was that? Yeah. Then I did a couple of things on my own. I tore down a couple of buildings and small buildings, just stuff on my own or with friends to get me through the summer. I left town in fall of 86, I went to Florida first and lived with my brother, and I worked there. And in that spring, I moved to Baltimore and worked in Baltimore for about 8 months. That was been April of 87.
Mm-hmm.
And worked in Baltimore till March of 88. And I headed back to Alaska. And the railroad opened.
Why did you decide to go back to Alaska?
Because I really didn't like Baltimore.
You missed Skagway?
Yeah. And I knew I could find work there. And it was springtime. So, but the railroad opened, and I was able to get hired to be the dispatcher for the first year of the railroad, and then I became a brakeman and eventually an engineer, and it was turned into my longest career.
Yeah. You retired with them, huh?
Yeah.
So you I mean, being dispatch is on the job. Were they all sort of on the job training? Dispatch, brakeman, and engineer?
Yes. Yeah. For engineer, I was conductor. They actually sent us to school in Kansas City, and that would have been in spring of 98. We got to go to the Kansas City. We did probably just 1 week of classes with simulators and a real engineer teaching the class about locomotive operation.
Oh.
But mostly it was on-job training, which is still what they do today.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not like you go to college and get a degree in train engineering.
Right, right. But the big railroads now have programs that are, you know, months long for training conductors and engineers.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case on the White Pass. Everybody is taught on the job.
And what does the brakeman do?
The brakeman is one of two people on the train, just helping collect tickets, mostly there for the safety of the passengers, operation of the train, and train movements. Throwing switches, making sure, putting us on the right track, moving cars, putting trains together.
So in that job, you probably learned a lot just about the whole train operations and how the company worked and all that stuff.
Sure. My first year dispatching, when the railroad opened, we just had, my office was in upstairs in the shops, and I couldn't see out.
Oh, no.
I inhaled a lot of diesel fumes.
Yeah, how do you dispatch without being able to see?
Well, no, it's just all radio.
Yeah.
You know, and people come get their train orders in the morning, and I'd write those out.
And there probably weren't too many trains going back and forth at that time.
We only had two crews of three people. When the railroad reopened in 88, they'd had five-man train crews. They had an engineer and a fireman, and they had a conductor and a head-end brakeman and a rear brakeman on every train. Well, when it reopened, they did away with that head-end brakeman and the fireman, and so we had a three-man crew. And on passenger trains.
And these were all diesel trains by this point?
Yes. Our steam program began when the 73, which is now the main steam engine, was in static display at Bennett. And it was there along with the rotary snowplow.
Uh-huh.
And it was there when I was in my park years hiking over the trail in 77. So I remember going on the railroad, probably my first year as a brakeman, going up there and building an extra track to bring that 73 back to town.
Oh.
And where they started the restoration work on it.
Why did it need different track?
Well, it was on static display on a separate piece of track,
right,
from the main line. So they had to build a track.
Oh, there was no connector?
Right.
Okay. I thought if it was on a separate piece of track that the connection was still there.
No connection.
And then the rotary, is that the rotary plow that's now down by the depot?
It's on a static display in Skagway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they, where is the steam engine? I know the rotary was right down there by the old depot.
Well, right now they've painted a really old steam engine, number two, I think.
Yeah.
And which used to be across the street from the depot. But they painted it and they put it over there with the rotary.
Oh, okay.
In the static display behind the depot, south of the depot.
Okay.
The 73 is, well, hopefully it's back in town. They sent it out, I think, to totally rework the boiler.
Oh.
Because it was time. So they had no steam service last year.
So they still do steam service?
Oh, yeah.
The tourist train is now a steam operated?
It's in one of the trains. The current steam service is a what they call a Fraser Loop.
Oh, okay.
The steam train takes off, I don't know how often.
So it's like
this year.
One train out of their schedule, not one a day maybe, but one of their options is steam.
Right.
But when you were working on it, was there a steam option?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I became certified to fire and engineer the steam engine. I never really, really, really got to be the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And but I did quite a bit of firing.
Because that's a whole different way of operating a train than a diesel.
It's a different beast. Yeah.
Especially on those hills, I would think.
Yeah, right. It's because you've got to watch the water in your boiler on the hills. The water's all going to... So you got to make sure you got plenty of water in the boiler to not expose the top of your...
Oh, with the angle.
Yeah, you can't expose the crown sheet in the locomotive because it'll scald it.
I was just thinking about having a hot enough fire going... to have enough steam to get you up those hills.
Right. Well, it was oil-fired. Originally coal, but they converted it in 1947 to oil.
That makes it a little easier, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't have to shovel coal. There's that.
Yeah.
We burned a special oil that burns real hot.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's very cool.
And they put the rotary snowplow back in service.
Oh.
And we started taking that up and doing some clearing on the line. Oh, gosh. Early 2000s?
Mm-hmm.
And originally we used a couple of diesels to push it. The rotary has its own steam engine, and that just drives the wheel to plow the snow and throw it off to the side. So it has to be pushed.
Okay.
The original rotary fleet, back in the day, used two steam engines to push the rotary. So they had a 9-man crew.
I assumed that the rotary was an engine in and of itself, and I didn't realize it had to be pushed by something else.
It does.
Interesting. Yeah. They're so cool, those old rotary.
Yeah. Things. There's some great photographs. The last time we had the rotary out was 2009, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time we had what we still have, the 69, which is another steam engine they acquired. They had, it was originally on the White Pass. It got, they sent it out, got rid of it, and then they, it was sitting in a museum in Grand Island, Nebraska. And they got it back.
Wow.
And put it back together. And so that was one of that. And the 73 were two engines that pushed the rotary in 2009, which was the last time we used it. And we went all the way to Bennett with it.
Wow. Now, were you actually clearing snow with it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Going uphill.
Yeah. Yeah, uphill, downhill.
Cool. Because normally the train doesn't operate in the winter anymore, does it?
No. And when they clear snow, they use bulldozers. Mm-hmm. They use cats, D6
right.
cats. The rotary originally, in the construction of the railroad, they built snow sheds in areas that were particularly susceptible to drifting.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a mile of snow sheds between Skagway and Bennett.
Right, and the snow shed covers the track, so the snow...
Yeah, it's like a lean-to over the track.
Right, so the snow, if there's a slide, whatever, it goes over the tracks and you're not covering the tracks, in theory.
Right, right.
Right.
So the in areas where the snow would be too deep for the rotary, it couldn't throw it to the side.
Right.
Right. So that's where they had to have a snow shed.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So, but yeah, originally they had two steam engines pushing the rotary.
Wow.
With a 9-man crew.
Yeah.
There was a pilot. The rotary had a pilot, a person in the front could peer out and see what they were doing. And he was giving directions to his engineer and to the whole fleet of when to push forward, when to back up.
Yeah, because
they had whistle signals.
Oh, because, yeah, you probably, if there's a big drift, you'd have to kind of push in, dig through, come back out, push some more, dig through. You couldn't just keep going all the way through.
Right, right.
Because they get pretty hard packed, those drifts.
Yeah, right. So the snow is going to have different characters depending on the weather. And
those pilots probably were pretty talented.
Yeah, they when we were doing our operation, we brought in the old heads.
Oh, cool.
Alvin Gordon. I think, is Alvin still with us?
I don't know. So he was an old pilot.
Yeah, yeah. We brought in Jasper Sullivan. I think he lived in Haines, but he was on the rotary fleet back in the day.
You know, since you switched over from the Park Service to White Pass, once you were with White Pass and it was, you know, now back running as a tourist operation, you have any sense of what the relationship was like between White Pass and the Park Service? Did they have things they worked together on or against each other on?
There was Ed Bennett. We had interaction with the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up with interpretive programs for our guests of the railroad.
Okay.
At one time, Christine and her colleagues
in Parks Canada.
Would do a tour of the Bennett area. Have you been to Bennett?
Not yet.
Okay.
I will.
Good. It's beautiful. Bennett's a real special
because
place.
Because the Klondike Highway does not go through Bennett, correct?
That's correct.
Yes. Okay.
So we had interaction there, and officially, I think there was cooperation. There was some... there were some personal problems. Railroad employees that just didn't like the park and weren't not all that cooperative. So there was that.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, often we would help the Rangers bring in their, pardon me, their supplies. Often when the train's going into Bennett, we would meet the Rangers with their supplies in mm-hmm. Fraser.
Okay.
In mile 28. And their most direct access to their camp was at the top of the hill above Bennett
okay.
on the way in. And so we'd stop the train and unload their stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was cooperation in that regard.
Well, and I don't know if you know when it started that, you know, hikers coming off the trail come to Bennett and take the train back to Skagway, and it seems fairly well coordinated. And I
yeah.
don't know how long that's happened, that it's a pretty coordinated schedule.
Right. Well, that arrangement's been going on since I was there.
Okay.
You know, we...
I didn't know if
the hikers could go to Bennett, they could buy a meal there
mm-hmm.
And get on the train.
I didn't know if it used to be more like a whistle stop that hikers would just flag the train down.
No. What we call whistle stops is on the U.S. side between Skagway and White Pass.
Okay.
And it was established pretty early on that hikers could get on and off the train at Denver at mile 5
mm-hmm.
and at Glacier at mile 14. And in recent years, well, more recent years, there's been a tour operator, Packer Expeditions,
mm-hmm.
that arranged to bring their people on the train.
Mm-hmm.
You can get on, and they, you know, bring lunch and everything, and they take their people to either Denver or Glacier, and then they get picked up later in the day.
So they're sort of leading guided hikes for people out to
those
correct.
Places. That's well, correct.
Didn't there used to be a way from Chilkoot you could get to Fraser instead of going all the way to Bennett? And there were...
There may have been a trail to Fraser. It never established.
No. But it's like a shortcut or... yeah, there's something that you didn't have to necessarily always go to Bennett. There was some other place. Maybe I'm
there was a cutoff.
Yeah.
At mile 37 and a half.
Okay, so it's
and
not
they,
Fraser.
And
okay.
recent, I think they got... They put the kiboshers on that in... like 2013,
mm-hmm.
2012, 2013, they like closed the trail, but people still used it.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Is that an issue between the park and the railroad?
Yes. Yeah.
If people went there, how would they get the train? Or they hiked to the road?
Right.
Is that I don't remember how that works.
They would if they came out to 37 and a half, they'd just have to hike along the track out to Log Cabin,
right.
where the highway is.
Okay. And was that the issue? Was having hikers along the track?
Yes. Yeah. In 2005, we did a lot of work on that track between Bennett and Log Cabin
mm-hmm.
and created more of a walkway alongside the track because we knew people were going to walk that whether mm-hmm. they were told to not do it or not. So they did create a more of a wider path.
Okay.
And it worked out pretty good.
And so what year did you retire from White Pass?
2015.
Okay. And then you guys moved down here?
Yeah, we originally went to Las Vegas, New Mexico and rented a house and started looking around for a place to be. And my sister moved here in 2006 from Mukilteo, Washington, with my mother. So I started, my mother's birthday was in March. I'd usually come down and help her celebrate her birthday mm-hmm. right before I went to work on the railroad. And So I was familiar with that area, and Sue was able to come with me a couple times in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So she was, we were familiar enough with it that when we saw it, we came up to visit my sister in the summer of 2016. I say, wow, it's green here. And look at those mountains. And, well, we can do this.
So
and then we'd be near my sister. So.
And you didn't want to stay in Skagway after retirement?
We wanted to be closer to family and be closer to medical, the same old story,
right,
you know.
Right.
Yeah, Sue was tired of the rain. She thought it was too rainy there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like Skagway was a good place for you. Would you say that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yep. Lots I had a very happy life there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to talk about, either Park Service, White Pass, that I haven't asked about? You've had a while to think about this interview, so I don't know if you've thought about things.
Yeah, but I really haven't had any more luck coming up with memories, especially from the park days. My railroad memories are more recent. I would like to think that I could go on about that, but I don't think we really need to add anything.
Okay. I mean, we could take a break if you think of something else.
How about lunch?
Yeah, that sounds good.
And let's be done.
Okay.